Welcome to Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. Host Tucker Perkins recorded this special episode from Reuters Energy Transition North America in Houston, where he talked to business leaders and other experts at the forefront of driving climate innovation. Now, here's Tucker.
In the words of our guest in this special episode of Path to Zero, the United States is segregated, and so is pollution. Dr. Robert Bullard is often called the father of environmental justice. We're honored to have this opportunity to talk to Dr. Bullard while we're in Houston. He's a distinguished professor of urban planning and environmental policy and director of the Bullard Center for Environmental and Climate Justice at Texas Southern University. Dr. Bullard, we're so honored to have you. Thanks for joining us on Path to Zero.
My pleasure.
I don't know that I've talked to anyone who has a center named after them, and maybe we'll talk about that in a bit. But, you know, we've dedicated quite a few episodes of Path to Zero to environmental justice, but I think it would only be fair and proper to have you tell our listeners how you think the environmental justice, how that concept evolves, what it means. Start there with a complete primer, if you will, on what environmental justice is.
Environmental justice embraces the principle that all people and communities are entitled to equal protection of our environmental laws, regulations. And the environment is everything. We live, work, play, worship, as well as the physical and natural world. So that when we define environmental justice, we're not just talking about the issues around landfills, incinerators, climate, greenhouse gases. We're talking about the total picture. And this has not been the case for many years. You know, we had the first Earth Day was 1970, and it was mostly dealing with issues that didn't involve the issues of justice. It didn't deal with where pollution burdens are disproportionately borne, which communities have contributed least to the issues of environmental degradation and climate. Yeah. And so the assumption was that all communities are feeling the same impacts of environmental challenges as well as climate. The environmental justice movement brought to the forefront the fact that poor people and people of color who have contributed least to this environmental crisis feel the pain first, worst, and longest. And it just so happened I got drafted into this way back in 1979, 3 years here in Houston, and while at Texas Southern University. I was an assistant professor, untenured, 3 years out of graduate school. And my wife, Linda McKeever Bullard, who's a lawyer, came home one day and said, "Bob, I just sued the state of Texas and city of Houston and Harris County and this landfill company, this waste disposal company." And I said, "You just sued my employer because I worked for a state university." And she said, "Yes." And the lawsuit was about, it was the first lawsuit being versus Southwestern Waste Management Corporation, the first lawsuit in the United States to challenge environmental discrimination using civil rights law. And this was a case, plain and simple, cut to the chase, of this company was planning a permit for a municipal landfill in Northeast Houston in the middle of this black middle-class suburban neighborhood, Northwood Manor. My wife challenged that permitting process, and I got it drafted, selected, to collect data for and do a study for this particular case. Now, that's how I got involved. My background is sociology, it's a concentration in demography from Iowa State University. And my research was on housing, residential patterns, and discrimination. And so I was asked to transfer those skills to looking at putting landfills, incinerators, and garbage dumps on a map and tell who lives around it. That was 1979. And before there was Google, GIS, laptops, iPhone, and all of that stuff.
And really,
put Houston, I think, as the city that really founded, I think, most of what we now refer to as environmental justice. I'm not sure we referred to it as that then, but that whole movement really started here in Houston.
True.
Well, I'd say that the research to document the disproportionate impacts of pollution and connecting that with race and place and laying out on a map and challenging the process by which these permits were granted in a city that didn't have zoning. So it meant that somebody and some agencies were systematically targeting Black communities. There were no research on this before we did the study. And so we, Linda McKeever-Buller laid out the legal strategy, the legal theory for environmental disparities, environmental discrimination, environmental racism. And my job was to do the empirical study. Mm-hmm. So yes, I'd say that the first studies that were done while I was at Texas Southern University with students in the sociology department here in at Texas Southern University.
And from that beginning, you now lead a center that bears your name, the Bullard Center at Texas Southern University. Tell our listeners what the Bullard Center does.
Well, our center, the Bullard Center for Environmental and Climate Justice, is basically focusing on education training, research and policy, and working with communities that are impacted by environmental challenges, community-university partnerships, research to action, community-based participatory research. All this stuff was done that now have a name. Way back in the late 70s, didn't have a name. What our center does is it builds on four decades of defining and the challenges and getting the information directly from communities in terms of what their challenges are, involving them in the research, in the policy, in the training, and with the goal of impacting policy and bringing about transformative change. And this is the second center that I've founded. The only one that has my name on it. But I founded a center after leaving the University of California in 1994, going back to my alma mater, Clark Atlanta University, and starting a center there, the Environmental Justice Resource Center, in 1994. And it's not by accident that the first five centers at environmental justice centers at universities in the United States, all five of them were started at HBCUs, historically Black College and University, the Environmental Justice Resource Center at Clark Atlanta University, the Deep South Center for Environmental Justice at Xavier University, Environmental Justice Institute at Hampton University in Virginia, the Environmental Health Institute at Florida A&M University, and the Environmental Justice Legal Clinic at Thurgood Marshall School of Law. Our centers that were founded in the 90s laid the foundation for our environmental justice research, policy, and for the environmental justice movement.
Are we in a better place today than you think we were 15 years ago, as it relates to environmental justice?
Oh, there's no doubt about it. We are better off today than we were 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. Bean versus Southwestern Waste Management Corporation, the first lawsuit that I talked about, the challenge of environmental racism, that was 44 years ago. Today, we have environmental justice centers, not just at HBCUs, at many major universities across the country. When I was doing the research in 79, there was no funds or foundation monies or government funds for this. Today, we have the Inflation Reduction Act, which has $370 billion for climate. But of that $370 billion, there's $60 billion for environmental justice, and another $60 billion for clean energy transition. So when we talk about the gains that we have made over the last four decades, they have been tremendous. We have greater tools to refine and locate and measure where environmental justice and climate risks are located. We have greater tools for tracking resources, money, benefits for trying to solve these many problems. And lastly, I would say, which really is a major change, is that we have an intergenerational mobilization across the various disciplines, as well as the different age groups. We have young people now who represent the majority population of our country. I'm a boomer, proud of it, still fighting, still standing. But millennials, Zoomers and Gen Xers, they outnumber my generation. So that's the new majority. And they see environmental and climate justice as their issue of the day, just like in my generation, they were fighting for justice, that we saw civil rights. These are major changes for the good. We made a lot of progress, but we've got a lot of work to do still.
Yeah, amen to that. You've written 18 books by my count, but I want to zero in on one book, The Wrong Complexion for Protection. Talk to us about what you were, the message that you're sending with that book.
Well, the title of that book really sends a clear message that in America, all people and communities are not created equal. We wish that were the case. We wish we had the, you know, and justice for all. But if we look at the fact that in our society, pollution is segregated, and so is America. And that if one lives in a community that is inhabited largely by low income, working class, or people of color, and where those residents live in physically zip codes or located on the quote wrong side of the tracks or the levee or the river or the bayou, then they're most likely to receive more harms than the general population. And so we still have a class line, a racial line, and a color line, and it's artificially imposed and artificially will subject some communities to more pollution and more bad outcomes in terms of health than others. And at the same time, the things that make communities healthy, parks, green space, issues of access to healthcare, good transportation, good schools, those things can also be segregated by income and by race. And so what we say is that our goal in terms of the environmental justice movement is to not let your zip code somehow be more powerful than the fact that your genetic code or your access to ability to learn and earn and get a great education and all those things. It's artificial kinds of barriers that keep people into places and spaces that create greater vulnerability. We learned during COVID that the same communities that were experiencing environmental hazards and more pollution and higher asthma rates were the same communities that were had a higher rate of hospitalization and deaths from COVID. And so what we say is that we have to take all of these factors into account. And there's a concept called social determinants of health. And those social determinants oftentimes can play a major role in bad health outcomes as well as good health outcomes when it comes to the built environment and health. And so when we talk about infrastructure, we know that all infrastructure is not created equal. The fact that Houston has the largest medical center in the world, but it also just, you know, 25, 30 minutes away going east has the largest concentration of refineries, petrochemical plants, and polluting facilities that we know create jobs, but it also create negative impacts on those communities and residents that are nearby. We have to make sure that no community, no residents that's impacted and their health is somehow lifespan, longevity is artificially dampened or decrease because of where they live. Now, that's the environmental justice, the climate justice, and the equity framework that we apply across the board. Whether we're talking about a highway, freeway, or whether we're talking about access to healthy foods, a grocery store, or a park or green space, or access to quality, access to clean energy, renewables, having good access so that our households don't live in what's called energy insecure households, paying more for energy than they can afford, or paying more for food than they can afford, or paying more for housing than they can afford. All those things, when you combine, will make for vulnerability. And what our center does at Texas Southern and other centers in collaboration with our HBCU Climate Change Consortium is to work with those communities where our schools are located, and work with those community-based organizations and nonprofits, and form those partnerships to identify those needs and to work on solutions, real solutions.
Thank you so much. Dr. Bullard, how do you go about equitably deciding where to put a new power plant or a new transmission line or an airport, or for that matter, the shopping mall? What are the considerations that you recommend people consider when we need to build these facilities that we need to build today?
I think it's important that we, when we do our analysis and we do our mapping and we do the community engagement, and we look at the historical patterns of industrial facility siting and commercial siting and other kinds of non-industrial, non-residential facilities, we have to take into account those communities that historically, before we had any types of regulations or any types of restrictions, that overburdened communities should not somehow continue to be overburdened. And we must, those goods must be distributed in a way. When I talk about good, I'm talking about land uses that make communities healthy. Good land uses and healthy outcomes in terms of the built environment should be considered, and not just place the bad things in one sector and one area. Even Houston, that a city that doesn't have zoning, has allowed certain types of locally unwanted land uses, or LULUs, to concentrate in certain areas. The east side and the west side are demographically different, as well as when it comes to land uses and when it comes to the physical and the built environment that we know can make communities healthy or can make them less healthy. And so when we talk about placing a park, a grocery store, a shopping mall, or another refinery or petrochemical plant, or a cement batch plant, all those things need to be taken into account. But the way it oftentimes operate is market forces will drive those facilities, the negative facilities, the locally unwanted land users, toward the path of least resistance. And oftentimes the path of least resistance has been those communities that have always borne the burden, for example, of waste facilities. Everybody produces waste, whether you're poor or rich, but everybody doesn't bear the burden of hosting those facilities. We must look at the total package and not just allow that path of least resistance or that community that historically have borne that those burdens. And people say, well, that's the way it's always been. The always been has gotten us in trouble. And so our justice movement is set out to correct that, and correct it in a way that provides benefits, opportunities, and health and positive health outcomes and benefits for all.
Are there any examples where you think the narrative today is particularly good or particularly bad as we think about, I mean, specifically the environmental and energy transition and environmental justice? Any shining examples or terrible examples?
Well, I think the fact that the Inflation Reduction Act has some powerful policies and programs, and has enough money to be transformative. When we talk about energy transition, clean energy transition provides opportunities for communities that and residents who have not had a lot of success in getting their energy utilities on bills under control, because of, in many cases, their homes are not the most energy efficient, and in cases of getting access to renewables such as solar panels and wind energy, I think there's opportunities to provide greater access, not just to homes, to our schools, solarizing the schools, in terms of buses, getting greening our ports, and getting more of our school boards and city councils and county commissioners and state legislators to say that green, having clean green energy has positive benefits, whether and getting more opportunities for working class and low income, middle income households access to electric vehicles, whether it's private automobiles or we're electrifying our public transit system. We're cleaning the air, getting more health benefits by not having polluted air, and not having our region be in non-compliance when it comes to ozone or PM2.5 or other kinds of particulate matter. These are opportunities to not only have a good impacts when it comes to climate by lowering emissions and lowering the greenhouse gas impacts overall, but also having good health impacts by not having the other pollution, not just greenhouse gases, but other co-pollutants in terms of, as I said, in terms of particulate matter, in terms of ozone, in terms of other kinds of pollutants that we need to get out of the atmosphere, get out of the air, get out of the communities, and so that we can have much healthier communities and more livable communities, and so that people can have more money to spend on other activities other than going to the hospital and somehow being treated for respiratory illnesses and other illnesses. There's lots of positive signs that it's occurring, and so we just have to accelerate that.
Yeah, it's good. Do you worry at all about that all of those things you just mentioned will increase the cost of electricity and therefore may be most impactful on the people you're really thinking about?
What we're talking about is not to have any types of improvements as we transition to a clean energy economy, not have the impacts be regressive. For example, the administration, the current administration has this Justice 40 initiative. And what that Justice 40 initiative says that 40% of the benefits from transitioning to a clean energy economy should go to disadvantaged communities, communities historically that have been left out and left behind. So built into that Just Transition or that Justice 40 initiative are the subsidies, are the opportunities so that we don't see regressive impacts, so that we see the tax credits and the benefits. For example, low-income schools that are in low-income areas that have not been able to upgrade their school to be silver, gold, or platinum LEED certified, we say that we need to see that our school boards apply for those funds so that our schools that have deficiencies as it comes to the infrastructure can get the monies to retrofit, that can get the monies to the schools, but also where there are problems in terms of lead in the water or the problems of dirty diesel school buses, to have those buses be clean energy electric buses, so that we can have our schools in our urban inner city areas have the same benefits as those schools that are in the suburbs that are in more affluent areas. No, we will fight hard and long to make sure that we don't somehow have the costs that will somehow be burdensome to those families and households that can at least afford it. That's what we see as the just transition when it comes to energy, when it comes to issues of access to green jobs, training, access to those good paying jobs that in the energy sector, access to making sure that our neighborhoods have the trees and green canopy and green space so that it's not hotter. You know, in some urban neighborhoods, in cities, including Houston, it could be 10 to 15 degrees right. hotter in those neighborhoods. We have all this concrete. We're talking about greening up and cleaning up a legacy pollution so that we have healthy, sustainable, and resilient communities. We need to do this as climate change is here with us. It's getting hotter. We're getting these storms that are much stronger and they're more frequent. So we don't have a lot of time to debate or to waste on whether or not we should do it. We need to do it. We get all our all hands on deck. We need our universities involved, our community-based organizations involved, and our governments involved. We're doing this now. We see a lot of young people. As I said before, young people have taken this on as their mantra and as their issue of the day.
Do you think we're doing enough to talk about adaptation? And as we think about, because it certainly impacts a lot of communities, is the conversation, you mentioned walkable cities, green cities, cool canopies, completely agree with you. You think the conversation is adequate around adaptation, or is that just beginning?
No, we have to accelerate our conversation and our action. There, we know, and we can map this with geographic information system, with GIS. We can map the adaptation hotspots, and we know where they are. And we need to target those areas where we need to target the resources, because climate change has been with some of these communities for decades, communities that flood over and over and over again. We used to plan for disasters in the Gulf Coast June through November, but Winter Storm Uri hit us in February 21. So that we have to now start to work on adaptation plans, on mitigation plans, working on resilience plans 24, 7, 12 months out of the year. That's January to January. We have to do more, and we have to do much more for those hot spots where those communities and those residents are still trying to bounce back from not just Winter Storm Uri, but from Harvey. We have to do more, and we have to really get to the heart of policy, planning, and finance so that those things intersect and we get more of our frontline communities in those rooms speaking up for themselves and involved in the process of decision making. That's our goal, and we're doing that now, but we have to have much more of that moving forward.
I just commend you on the energy you bring to that whole conversation. It's just refreshing. Let me ask you one question. It's almost ask it in trepidation, but I want to ask it anyway because I think about it all the time. You mentioned a couple times Inflation Reduction Act, massive sums of money going into environmental issues. And then you talked then about schools, and you talked about having schools, they should be LEED or gold certified. No one would, I think, disagrees. You should have the same quality of schools as any community. But do you ever think about maybe some of the monies should be more directed, in fact, to having better teachers or better highways or better medical facilities? And perhaps do you ever worry that the pendulum has swung too far to spending money on climate and we're not focusing enough on mental health, true infrastructure, schooling? You ever think about that?
All the time. As I said before, at the beginning of the podcast, is that the environment is everything. We live, work, play, learn, worship, as well as the physical and natural world. We just can't talk about a highway or a building or a school. We have to talk about, that's hard infrastructure. We have to talk about the soft infrastructure, the people, the safety net. Building better schools also means getting better qualified teachers, paying them, and providing benefits for community-based organizations that can assist and support in the planning. And I've always said that we can't just leave planning just to planners. We need to bring all of the the resources and all of the disciplines to bear. When we talk about the Inflation Reduction Act, or we talk about those things that are in there as it relates to health, and health is more than when we talk about the absence of disease. Health also means mental health. Climate change is a health issue. And when we talk about providing more access to Obamacare or Affordable Care Act, or providing more access to opportunities for green jobs, good paying jobs in this energy transition, so that training also is not necessarily infrastructure per se, but it is part of the equation in terms of solutions. So we just can't build a highway and be done with it, because highways, infrastructure, historically have taken people from point A to point B and have provided access to opportunity. But the flip side of that, highways have destroyed, have a history of destroying stable communities, mm-hmm. Ripping through business corridors and displacing stable neighborhoods. We've seen that in Houston. We've seen it across the globe. I wrote two books on that. One book called Just Transportation, Dismantling Race and Class Barriers to Mobility, and another book called Highway Robbery. So when we talk about infrastructure, we have to understand the history of infrastructure, and that all infrastructure has not always been positive. And so we have to not unpack that and say, when we build something, we have to look at those benefits and those costs, and not build something that exacerbate those disparities. In some cases, yes. Highways have created more flooding. In some cases, when we build something, entire subdivisions, oftentimes for wealthy people, as you talk about downstream, it's created more flooding because you knock down right. trees, you put more concrete, you've done something. So we have to look at all of that as a whole. That's what yes. our environmental justice framework does.
I really appreciate your words. All right, let's have a little fun. This is an important thing for you, because I can't think of anyone who's going to have a better answer than you're going to give me. We use magic, and we're going to give you a magic wand. And with that wand, you can use it to change one thing in the next year that you think would have the biggest impact on climate change, sustainability. How would you use your wand, Dr. Bullard?
Wow. I think what I would do is really to accelerate the information, the education, the training, and the idea of ensuring that all of the resources that's been arrayed under the Inflation Reduction Act, the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law, and Justice 40 be targeted in a way that will have transformative impact. We have so much money in terms of billions and billions of dollars. As a matter of fact, $1.2 trillion under the Inflation Reduction Act. That this is an opportunity to make transformative change. If I had a magic wand, that we will make sure that that money will follow need, and not necessarily somehow get distorted by politics.
Yeah, awesome. All right, one other thing we do, and I know you're in Houston. You raised up in Alabama. We want to plant a tree in a national forest in honor of the time you spent with us and for the expertise you share with our listeners. Where is a national forest that you would like to have that tree planted?
Wow. That's a big one. You know, Alabama has a number of them. I'd say in and around Birmingham, Alabama, lot of forests.
We can find one there. That's great. We'll find a beautiful forest in and around Birmingham. Beautiful spot. Dr. Bullard, how can we learn more about what you're doing?
Well, anyone who wants to know more about what we're doing, they can go to our website. It's at bullardcenter.com. And if you don't want to go to the website, you can just Google Robert Bullard, environmental justice, and a lot of stuff will come up. 4 decades of it.
Well, I was doing the math, and I think you might even be being kind 4 decades. I think you're 45, 46 years, and I don't think you're finished yet. So I just want to thank you for your time. I want to thank you for your energy. I want to thank you for your just representing those who need to be represented. And I really appreciate you being with us on Path to Zero. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to a special edition of Path to Zero with Tucker Perkins. If you like what you've heard, subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to pathtozero@propane.com.